Próximo, Kaoban.
Peter.
Well, good evening, everyone. I'm attempting to use some technology tonight, which is a little outside of my realm of experience, so hopefully everything goes smoothly. I wanted to consider this subject this evening. We have, of course, the Word of God, the Bible, which we believe to be the Word of God, and we have unfathomed information about him and who he is and his plan, and we learn about us and so many incredible things we learn from the words of this book. And I also believe that there is a multitude of things to be learned from the things which he has made, from the creation around us. And I think that we can lose that in our modern Western age, in Victoria in 2023. We mitigate ourselves in so many ways from God's creation. You know, it doesn't matter to us really if it rains or shines. It doesn't really matter to us when the sun comes up or goes down. It doesn't matter the changes of the seasons. We're not really reliant on many of these things. We have our shelters, we have our clothing, we have our electricity, we have our energy. All those things mitigate us and in many ways really separate us from God's creation, from the realities and the power and the intricacies and the majesty of God's creation. We go to grocery stores for our food and so on. And I believe God has contained just wonderful and incredible lessons for us and information for us in his creation and the things that he's made. And our reading today from Job chapter 12, I think we read that in verses 7 to 9 to 10, this section, asks the beasts, and they will tell you. There is answers, there's information, there's knowledge to be learned from all of the creatures, from the fowls of the air, they will tell thee. Speak to the earth in geology, and it will teach thee. and the fishes of the sea will declare unto thee. And even these things have information for us and have incredible lessons for us. So when it comes to this idea of creation versus evolution, maybe that's not the greatest title. It's not very creative anyways, but here we are. For most of history, really, there wasn't a lot to talk about when it comes to this subject. It was very well understood until relatively recently that everything that we experience and everything that we know about the world, and indeed the universe from whatever, you know, telescopes that, is it Aristotle? Back in the day had everything that we understood about this world, we knew indeed to be the product of an intelligent designer. So really there was not a lot to talk about in this particular venue. And now certainly there was much debate perhaps about the identity and the details of this particular creator, but not about his existence. So when Charles Darwin came along and a few of his predecessors and certainly many of his disciples following it with his theory of evolution and natural selection in his particular brand, the completely random and undirected coincidences which brought everything into being as he taught, only then was there any sort of discussion or debate really in this venue. Now his ideas have kind of reigned supreme for many years. Until recently, it's become clear that there are very significant and inescapable flaws in this theory. Now, we have absolutely incredible technology these days, which they didn't have 100 or 200 or 150 years ago when Darwin was around. And with this incredibly sophisticated technology that we have now, we're able to peer deeper and deeper down into the minutiae of the details of this world and also out into the vastness of space. And we're able to see things and understand things and learn things now that were absolutely impossible 150 years ago. And we're able to learn of the absolutely staggering complexity in even the most basic and the most simple forms of life. And when Darwin was around doing his thing, the the simplest cell, a simple blob of protoplasm, as it was described, it was easy to buy into that because we couldn't tell anything different. The most powerful microscopes, which were so groundbreaking in their day, revealed the cell as just a lifeless, shapeless kind of blob. And of course, now we know that nothing could be further from the truth than that. And so if you have and you hold this cell to be just a simple blob of nothing, then it's not a stretch to assume that maybe... Sorry?
Were you showing that?
Nope. Did something happen?
Well, the mouse was moving, so I thought maybe you were trying to show us something.
Oh, maybe I just got too close to my... Yeah, exactly. you know, and if that's the deepest understanding you have of a cell, then it's not a stretch to think that it maybe could just spontaneously arise out of nothing, out of the primordial soup, so to speak. But no one in their right mind would think that a jumbo jet would arise from the same soup. Of course, that's just ridiculous. And the simple tools of Darwin's day, which couldn't come close to understanding the magnificent complexity of the cell, have given way to the amazing technology we have now, which allows us to see not only the cell itself, but also the miraculous structure and the mechanisms which go on inside every single tiny, tiny cell. Mechanisms so intricate and so calculated that they make that jumbo jet look like the blob of protoplasm by comparison. So we have a few verses. We've already touched on our Job verse here where Job explains that even creation, did it do it again?
No.
That even the creation around us, everything we see around us has a lesson, has a powerful lesson for us. Proverbs chapter 6, verse 6 says, "Go to the ant, thou sluggard," in the King James Version. I think we understand from that the powerful lessons of the ant, which gather their food in the summer, I think it says, and prepare for the winter. Perhaps I've misquoted that verse, but it's not far off. So, you know, Solomon, in his wisdom, understood the incredible powerful lessons which come from nature around us. And we'll turn to Romans chapter 1 before we continue. And Paul, in his letter to the Romans, and we'll read verses 19 and 20. Let's start at verse 18, I guess, just at the beginning of the sentence. "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness. Because that which may be known of God, what we can understand about God, is manifest or is made known in them, for God has showed it to them. For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world, they're clearly seen, being understood by the things which are made, by his creation itself, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that we're without excuse." There are so many lessons and so many principles within creation that God has created that we can learn about him. So I think it's maybe not a biblical study, so to speak, but I believe that we can't go wrong in studying God's creation. So we have a video to watch here. I think it's about 12 minutes or so. So this is where I'm hoping that my technology cooperates. It's pretty cool. All right, let's see if this works and we have volume and all the rest of it.
"Our machines, they enable us to be creative and produce spectacular structures. We also find magnificent structures in nature, and each of these living structures was also built by machines, machines that are far more elaborate than anything that humans have ever built. In fact, this log is currently being decomposed by tiny fungi that are vastly more complex than this drone. I'm Mike McGee. Welcome to the unseen world of organic micro-machines. Every living thing in the world is made of cells. Microbes are single-cell organisms. Advanced life forms have trillions of cells. Inside of the cell is a bustling operation of interconnected molecular machinery so sophisticated it would put any modern high-tech factory to shame. This intricate machinery is what gives the cell its remarkable abilities to process energy, execute genetic instructions, and replicate, all with unbelievable efficiency. I'm a biochemist, a scientist who studies the molecules of life. There's never been a more exciting time to be a life scientist. This is a golden age of discovery in molecular biology. Stunning breakthroughs in our understanding of the most fundamental unit of life, the cell, have been coming faster and faster. My own view of the cell took a turn years ago. I was in a lab at the National Institutes of Health doing postdoctoral research. I was discussing the origin of life with a fellow postdoc. As she and I thought about the cell, we wondered, how could its complex membrane, proteins, metabolism, genetic code, how could all that have formed by the accumulation of undirected changes? So we were both sort of stunned by the notion, but then we just laughed it off. We figured that even if we didn't know the answer, somebody must know. Well, in the 10 years after that, I didn't come across any science publications that adequately answered the nagging question, exactly how did the cell get to be so complex? Everything I read presumed that those biological mysteries would eventually be solved by Darwin's theory of evolution. Being an evolutionist myself, that was fine with me. Then I came across a book titled Evolution of Theory and Crisis by a geneticist, Michael Denton. It addressed profound problems with Darwin's theory. It asked hard questions about the origin of life. And it showed that science didn't have the answers. No matter that everyone assumed it did, or assumed that it would eventually, or something.
So maybe that was not the clearest audio coming through, but perhaps we get the purpose of that, the point of that. So this guy was a scientist, believed in evolution, lock, stock, and barrel, and started asking questions and wondering where all this sort of came from. And as he said, he really didn't find any suitable answers. He just assumed that someone knew or there was an answer out there somewhere, and maybe he himself was a bit ignorant, but surely there were some wiser people than himself, and that someone knew. But as he goes on to say, in fact, there was not any answers. There was nothing to answer his questions. And this is actually really important for us to understand. This evolutionary theory of Darwin, or a morphed, updated version of his ideas, is presented throughout the world as settled science, as absolutely based upon fact. But it's far from it. In reality, there are so many holes and gaps in this theory. And more they are being exposed as our technology increases and we're able to understand more and more. Science is the pursuit of knowledge, in a sense. So to suggest that science can be settled in some ways is an oxymoron. It's the continual gathering of information, so inevitably new information will arise. And everything in our world is based upon this notion of evolution, that we have all come from apes, so to speak. All humans have come from apes, and everything from, all on its way up through these processes of natural selection. And so it's difficult to understand and to do research and to learn based when the fundamental platform is based on this flaw. So with many of these latest discoveries, things like DNA, although it's not super, super recent, discovered in the 50s, but still this was absolutely monumental in our understanding of cells and our biology and humans. And the complexity of DNA in the human genome was so staggering that it really, that in itself, could blow this entire theory of evolution right out of the water. It's so mind-bogglingly complex that any sort of random chance of evolution just becomes laughable. So it's more and more clear that undirected processes certainly could not be responsible for the incredible vast diversity of life that we have on this planet, let alone its origin from that so-called primordial soup.
Here's a bacterium, a single-cell microbe. Some bacteria have a flagellum, which is like an outboard motor on a boat. It rotates to propel bacteria through liquid, and it's necessary for their survival in order to swim and search for food. A flagellum has a number of parts, a drive shaft, a universal joint, a rotor, bushings, stator, even a clutch and braking system. The motor of the flagellum has been clocked at 100,000 revolutions per minute. And as with the mousetrap, removing even one component of this elegant machine destroys its function and renders the bacterium, shall we say, dead in the water.
This is again important to understand. It's critical for us to understand that every single element of every single life form is in fact complete and it's fully functioning. So this flagellum, the little spinny thing that drives the most minuscule microscopic bacteria, it's complete. There's no missing or or extra parts in it. There's no spare parts, additional parts. There's no partial parts. We need to understand this because if life was formed by these natural random processes, we should expect to see partially completed parts in every organism, everywhere. There should be these half-formed, extra, missing parts in everything, everywhere, if this is, in fact, an ongoing, undirected process. But even Darwin himself admitted that nowhere in the entire fossil record is there any scrap of evidence of in-between life forms, of any of these stages that are partial or missing or incomplete, right? So we talked about that. I think it was four components or five components of the flagellum, the actual tail, and then the joint, which allows the tail to move in different directions, and the bearings and the, or bushings, I think is one of the descriptions of it, and the motor and the stator, and this process spins, or this motor spins at 100,000 revolutions per minute. We'll talk about that a bit later on, but so I'll probably repeat myself in a bit. But if you have a high performance sports car now, you might get up to 8,000 revolutions per minute. If you have a super crazy sport motorbike, maybe you'll get 12,000 revolutions per minute. And this tiny, tiny microscopic single-celled organism can spin its motor at 100,000 revolutions per minute, can stop that motor in 1/4 of a rotation, and spin it backwards again at 100,000 RPM. It's just so staggering. Anyway, let's continue on.
We don't typically ponder the elegance of bugs, especially the annoying ones. But scientists and engineers have come to realize they are actually mechanical marvels. Nothing we humans have ever built even comes close. In fact, a growing field of engineering called biomimetics is making breakthroughs by mimicking biology. For example, studying the eyes of flies led to the development of advanced optical sensors. The physics of dragonfly wings allowed increased efficiency of wind turbines. Cockroach mechanics paved the way for increased agility in robots. A honeybee algorithm helped to optimize the internet. And the tiny plant hopper is helping scientists to maximize the strength and rotation of gears.
What? Gears? In a bug? That would get my attention. I like humans who invented gears.
Those perfectly precise, interconnected drivers that have transformed machinery for centuries. Well, it turns out that biology is far ahead of our engineering. The plant hopper launches like a rocket. It can jump more than 100 times its body length. That's like an Olympic long jumper hurtling across not one, but two football fields. Using special cameras, scientists at Cambridge University discovered that the plant hopper coordinates the motion of its legs with these incredibly precise gears. Making long leaps accurately requires that the legs be in perfect sync. If one leg flexed even a fraction of a millisecond before the other, the insect would lose power and tumble erratically. As one leg begins to move, the interacting gears start the other leg too. With the teeth engaged, the gears spin at a whopping 50,000 teeth per second. And the bug is propelled with maximum power and coordination. As science learns more about the structures of living organisms, we seem to be finding limitless examples of mechanisms that are both precise and purposeful. Both remarkably configured and beautifully functional. Dogs are easily one of the most diverse species on Earth. Geneticists tell us it's likely that each of them descended from one animal, the wolf. These breeds look very different from each other, but they all share much of their DNA with those early wolves, and that's what makes them dogs. Now let's move inside the cell and see how this works. DNA is found in the nucleus of the cell. It consists of a long chain of chemicals designated by the letters A, G, C, and T. Some sections of DNA are called genes. They contain the specific instructions for making the proteins that form the cells that give the dog its traits. In our last episode, we saw that DNA in brown bears had mutated to form polar bears. Well, how does that work? A mutation in a gene occurs when there's a change in its sequence. Often this results in breaking one of the instructions for forming the animal. In this case, the mutation was in the specific gene that determines fur color. The disabled gene is unable to give instructions to make colored fur, so the mutant fur is white. The change in bears occurred long ago. Wouldn't it be great if we could observe mutation today in real time? Well, we're in luck. Critical work has been done in the laboratory of Richard Lenski, who worked with a species of bacteria called E. coli. The Lenski lab had been growing generations of E. coli in flasks for 30 years. In the early 1990s, they saw that the descendant bacteria began to grow faster than their ancestors. That was great news for the happy E. coli. But why was this happening? A decade later, they were able to determine the mutation that caused it. What they found was that a certain gene in the E. coli had been destroyed. Losing that gene ended up helping the bug grow faster. Then they looked at a dozen other couple mutant genes in the E. coli and saw that they too had been broken. Mutations had left the genes either crippled or completely disabled. But that seems odd. How can breaking a gene help the organism? Imagine you have to drive to a destination on one tank of gas, or you'll die. Given the weight of your car, you'll never reach your destination on just one tank. So you toss out the hood, a seat, floor mats, and a cigarette lighter. The lighter degraded car gets you to your destination, and you survive. So breaking genes can help E. coli adapt to a live environment. And broken genes help the polar bear adapt to the Arctic. How about our dog friends? In just the past 20 years, scientists have actually discovered many mutations responsible for traits of breeds. And again, the mutations don't construct new genes. Most of them break or damage pre-existing genes. For example, increased muscle mass in some breeds derives from degradation of the myostatin gene. We also know what mutations cause the yellow coat. Short tails. Even the lovable friendliness of dogs towards humans, compared to less friendly wolves. So a dog can be changed by breaking genes, but it comes at a high cost. The broken genes very likely will never return to their original working state. The dachshunds with short leg genes won't be returning to anything resembling a Labrador. And we won't see the polar bear mutate back to its old self eating berries. In short, helpful mutations are not a DNA upgrade. Getting into a smartphone is an upgrade. It's more helpful because it has completely new features. But mutations don't install new features in DNA. They often make changes to existing ones. A mutation is more like disabling the GPS. It may help save your battery, but it doesn't add a new function. We're told that random mutation is the main driver for evolutionary change, and that evolution is responsible for lower forms being upgraded to higher ones. Yet the latest scientific results show new species are made by breaking genes, by devolution, not evolution.
Okay, so this is another important point to consider. Devolution is actually more correct than evolution. Now, nobody doubts the mutations of DNA as we saw it and of the genes, but Darwinists believe that these mutations can add new features, and that's where the biggest deviation comes, because this is simply not true. You cannot add new features with degraded, broken, mutated genes. All mutations degrade the individual. They do not upgrade the individual. They take it further and further away from its initial design. And the vast majority of the time, the mutations are harmful or even fatal to the organism. Sometimes, very rarely, in fact, the mutations can have apparent benefits, as he mentioned in there, but they always come at a cost. And usually the mutated organism is weaker than its unmutated state. So I think I might have talked about this before, but this is going back a number of years. In July 22nd, 2010, marked the 100th anniversary of the genetic investigations using fruit flies, which is a perfect example. Fruit flies have short lifespans, and you can get around 30 generations per year. They're perfect for studying mutations because you have many, many, many generations of fruit flies. So any mutations are gonna cycle through, and you can actually study that. So their short generation time and their four pairs of chromosomes present prime testing grounds for evolution. In laboratories worldwide, they've been subjected to all manner of mutation-inducing phenomena, including hosts of chemical and radiation treatments to try and get them to evolve, to try and accelerate evolution mimicking mutations. Now, after all this, 100 years worth, fruit flies should have certainly exemplified evolution by now. In 100 years times 30 generations per year is 3,000? There's mathematicians out there. Is that right? 3,000 generations to study mutations. But the truth is, they have not evolved. So having achieved no evolutionary progress in fruit flies by these random means, researchers have made them the focus of countless purposeful gene manipulation studies. The most popular, from an evolutionary perspective, were experiments which were called HOX genes. HOX is an abbreviation of homeobox. They're genes used by the organism during embryonic development. And many reason that it would be simpler for evolution to operate by mutating these genes, these embryonic genes, since small alterations could produce a large effect in the fruit fly's body. However, this was before recent studies showed that embryonic development is more heavily influenced by regulatory DNA and not genes at all. And mutating through substituting, deleting, or duplicating, or just monkeying around with these genes, mutating development genes, like HOX, has only ever yielded a dead fly. A normal fly, if the mutations happen to have no noticeable effect, so there's three outcomes. It's either a dead fly, a normal fly, or a tiny monster. None of these results match the positive improvement, the beneficial mutation expected in Darwinian evolution. Extra body segments, an extra set of wings or legs in the place of antenna characterize these tiny monsters, these weird forms that were generated. Three generations of specifically designed DNA alterations were required to produce fruit flies with four wings, but they couldn't fly. The extra wings had no muscles. There was no structure behind these extra wings. They were just dead weight. And on a tiny fruit fly, there's not a lot of room for dead weight. They're not exactly, you know, high payload creatures. So these extra wings were just dead weight. One recent exploration of neo-Darwinism, as it's considered to be called now, these mutants that produced four-winged fruit flies survive today only in a carefully controlled environment and only when skilled researchers meticulously guide their subjects through one non-functioning stage after another. So the opposite of nature. They have to be so carefully cared for in these crazy situations that it's just plainly obvious that this is not a natural process. This carefully controlled experiment does not tell us much about what undirected mutations can produce in the wild. In his book, Evolution, Colin Patterson summarized the lost hope of finding evolution from HOX investigations. The spectacular effects of homeobox gene mutations were first seen in Drosophila, that's the Latin name for fruit fly, early in the history of genetics. Carriers of some of these mutations certainly qualify as monsters, though without much hope, he says. Whereas fruit fly studies have provided critical information about how genes, nerves, longevity, and other biological machines and processes operate, no progress whatsoever has been made in the quest to accelerate these insects' evolution by ramping up their mutations. Survivors of the 100 years of lab tortures are still just fruit flies. At the end of the day, they're just fruit flies. And so it's super important for us to understand that these mutations, which is the fundamental core of evolution, of neo-Darwinism, as it's called today, these random mutations, which are supposed to add upgrades and new features and new species, just, it falls flat. It falls flat in actual studies with fruit flies, and it falls flat in every other aspect and study of DNA and so on. Okay, so we have a little exercise here. Let's see if this works. All right, okay. So let's imagine for a second that this is a strand of DNA, or these are some instructions. It's essentially what DNA is. It's a code for constructing and building cells. So let's suppose for a minute that this is a string of DNA and these are some instructions. So if we start at our house, we turn right out of our driveway, we go straight at the lights, we turn left after Colville, turn left after Tillicum Mall, take your second right, turn left at the T, turn right onto Mackenzie, turn left in 3.7 kilometers is instructions that will get you from our house to the hall. Now, if we start monkeying around with this, like if we change, let's see if I can get this to work. If we change of to something random, that's okay. You can probably still figure out how to get there. That of isn't maybe as critical to the overall integrity of the whole thing. And so that's kind of what he was talking about with these random mutations. So you can get some that maybe aren't devastating or damaging or whatever, you know, and then maybe you can go, you know, let's see if there's another one. You can kind of get rid of some of these, you know, at the, oh, I'm not doing this very well. It's hard tracking this mouse up here. You know, maybe get rid of the lights and some other gibberish that goes in there. Go, oh, sorry, I forgot a space back there. You want to go straight. Right, you can sort of figure out, there's like some weird things in there and whatnot, but you can more or less figure it out. But then what happens if you take out, like, turn left, and you put something in there, then you're going to get lost in a hurry. Because you can figure out Tillicum, and you got to turn after Tillicum, but which way? And then you don't know. And you know, and so you can get away with some mutations, with some changes in the code, in the instruction, and you might be okay. But the more you start to have these deviations, you get further and further away and more lost and confused, and it doesn't work. It ends up that the instructions become useless, and the mutations to the instructions end up being futile. And you don't get to the hall. Now, let's see if I can pull this back onto my screen over here, so you don't read the rest of my notes. All right, what's going on here? All right, so as I say, if you start to make these mutations, you might get away with it for a little bit. Some of the things might be okay, but you're going to end up pretty quickly with something that just is non-functioning. It just doesn't get that. Now, you might say, if you were a contrary or you were a neo-Darwinist, you might say, well, what if your purpose is to go get groceries? Well, then it doesn't matter if you get to the hall, because you're going to get groceries. And if your purpose is to get groceries, well then, yeah, there's a better place to go. But if your purpose is to come together, to learn and to worship, then there isn't a better place to go. And then those directions are very important to get you specifically to this place. If, for example, you are, say, a red blood cell, it's very important that your function as a vehicle for carrying oxygen and other nutrients to the cell, it's very important that integrity is maintained. It's deadly critical, actually. If your blood decides to stop carrying those nutrients to your cells, then it's not going to end out very well. Now, we had just this short sentence up there of just a few words, and the amazing thing with the DNA molecule is that they range in length from hundreds of thousands of pairs up to millions of pairs of instructions. I don't know how many characters was in that sentence. 100, maybe, something like that. So we're talking hundreds of thousands to millions. The smallest chromosome in the human genome, the shortest chromosome, chromosome 21, has around 48 million pairs or characters, which need to be maintained in the correct sequence. It's a lot of sequences which need to be just perfect. So you think of these tiny, tiny little cells, the ones with the flagellum, the single-celled organisms, and the DNA in there, and the code, genetic code contained in the DNA in these tiny, tiny cells. It's utterly astonishing. That has to be complete and perfectly in place, or you have no cell. It just blows your mind to think that something of that complexity, a code of that length, a string of characters in that length, would just randomly, spontaneously come together in a bowl of soup. So imagine a set of directions that were, you know, hundreds of thousands of turns and instructions would be just crazy. All right, let's continue here. Oh, what am I doing here? There you go.
As we search for the X factor that accounts for the complexity of life, we have to follow the evidence. So what have we seen so far? Let's begin with the cell. What was a mystery to Charles Darwin is now well understood. We know that the cell encodes and transmits information that regulates the size and shape of living things. And we know the cell is comprised of insanely complex machinery. What's more, much of it is irreducibly complex. All the parts are necessary in order for an irreducibly complex system to work. Irreducibility is evidence that all the parts were formed intentionally, with the end purpose in mind, not randomly over time. Finally, Darwin's explanation for complexity was evolution, where random small variations over many generations progressively led to life of greater and greater sophistication. But science has just recently discovered that variation comes from genetic mutation, and that even helpful mutations usually break genes. That's not evolution, that's devolution. So what is the evidence for some X factor that accounts for biological complexity? Let's think about it. If you were to come across this formation for the first time, what can you conclude from examining? There's no apparent evidence that shows when it was made, who made it, or how it was made. But we do have clear evidence that it was not arranged randomly. It was planned by an intelligent being. The purposeful arrangement of parts, that is the way, the only way that we recognize the work of a mind. And the more intricately the parts are arranged, the stronger the evidence that a mind was at work. The X factor that accounts for complexity is intelligence. An intelligent being is responsible for much of life. The exquisite and purposeful design found throughout nature is overpowering evidence. You might say, hold on a second. Don't we have to see any arrangement being put together to decide for sure that it was done on purpose? After all, we can see how an intelligent builder constructs a home. If we can't see or understand how design occurs in nature, why should we believe there is an intelligence behind it? Well, it's what we can see that is the whole point. Suppose three visitors from a distant place stumble across this surprising stone configuration that they have never heard of before. Not knowing how it was formed, one visitor might think it a bit chiseled. The second guesses that power tools were used. The third might suppose it was cut by lasers. But none of them would conclude that Mount Rushmore was formed accidentally. Through gradual, random erosion by wind and rain, they would immediately know it was purposely designed, just by perceiving the intention behind the work. The purposeful design of nature was nearly universally held, common knowledge for millennia. Some thinkers, such as the philosopher Aristotle, believed that purpose was built right into nature. Others, such as Galen, the esteemed physician in Rome, thought that purpose had been added to nature. But almost everyone, educated or not, religious or not, realized that life was intentionally designed. Going beyond biology, other fields have acknowledged purposeful design through the ages. Astronomy, chemistry, and physics all reveal arrangement and order. Science took a detour from that strong consensus when Charles Darwin proposed random, unguided evolutionary causes. Now we know that Darwin was right for the case of small changes in life. But the void of evidence for large, random evolutionary changes supports the enduring consensus of purposeful design.
Okay, so we've got a little bit of time to talk about now about cells. So cells are absolutely astonishing, and I must admit a lot of this is maybe a bit beyond me. I push a button on a box for a living. So this is some of this stuff is absolutely incredible. But I think it's noteworthy, and it's unbelievable to consider the tiniest building blocks of our bodies to appreciate the designer. So the basic membrane, a cell is a basic membrane-bound unit that contains the fundamental molecules of life and of which all living things are composed. A single cell is often a complete organism in itself, such as an amoeba or bacteria or yeast. Other cells acquire specialized functions as they mature. These cells cooperate with other specialized cells and become the building blocks of large multicellular organisms such as humans and animals. Although cells are much larger than atoms, they are still very small. The smallest known cells are a group of tiny bacteria called mycoplasmas. Sorry, some of these words are like, some of these single-celled organisms are spheres as small as 2.2 micrometers. Micrometer, which is about 0.00039 of an inch. So it's just like, when you get to some of this stuff, the numbers are just, they're so fantastical that it's really difficult to actually kind of get a grasp of what we're talking about. So it talks about the mass of these things and how tiny they are. Human cells are typically 400,000 times larger than these tiny ones. And even a human cell, you need about 10,000 in a sheet to cover the head of a pin. So I'm not sure if that gives you a sense of just like the just mind-bending, like how minuscule things we're talking about here. each human organism is composed of more, now, I think this is 30 trillion cells is in our bodies. So it's just so difficult to comprehend these numbers that we're talking about. Cells are largely composed of compounds that contain carbon. We're carbon-based life forms. I'm sure you've probably heard that phrase before. The study of how carbon atoms interact with other atoms in molecular compounds form the basis of the field called organic chemistry. And it plays a large role in understanding the basic functions of cells. Because carbon atoms can form stable bonds with four other atoms, they are uniquely suited for the construction of complex molecules. These complex molecules are typically made up of chains and rings that contain hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, and carbon. So these are kind of the building blocks, the fundamental building blocks of all cells in organic chemistry, which is us. And it just makes me think, like, you know, God says that he made mankind out of the dust of the ground. You know what? It's right. It's true. We're simple molecules. We're simple atoms put together. Of course, we know the difference is the breath of life, which came from God, because these atoms on their own do nothing. So these molecules, these tiny molecules, consist of anywhere from 10 to millions of atoms linked together in very specific formations. Most, but not all, of the carbon-containing molecules and cells are built up with members of one of four different families of small organic molecules. We have sugars, we have amino acids, we have nucleotides, and we have fatty acids. And each of these families contains groups of molecules that resemble one another both in structure and in function. So there's, in these categories, there's, you know, more variety, but they're all very very similar in their shape, their structure, and also their function. And in addition to other important functions, these molecules are used to build larger macromolecules. For example, sugars can be linked to form polysaccharides. Is any chemist, is that right? Saccharides, oh, it's embarrassing. Such as starch or glycogen. The amino acids can be linked to form proteins. The nucleotides can be linked to form the DNA molecules and RNA in chromosomes. And the fatty acids are used to form the lipids, which actually create the membrane, the little sac of the cells. And there's about 100 trillion atoms in a human cell. It's an estimate, because not all human cells are exactly the same size. And there's about 100 trillion cells in a human. So again, as I say, these numbers are just, they're just so astonishing. Let's see if this is going to work. If I do that. Wow. That's great. I'm glad this worked. So this is an animal cell, and it's surrounded, the cytoplasm, which is this, which is kind of the liquid inside the cell. It surrounds all the specialized structures within the cell. The ribosomes the sites of protein, sites of the ribosomes are the sites of the protein synthesis. So that's where they actually build the proteins. And this is what that video started off with. You know, we look at our structures, we look at our buildings and our highways and our skyscrapers, and we marvel at the machinery that's gone together to put this all together. And this is happening like in 100 trillion cells inside our bodies all the time. It's just, it is so astonishing and so staggering. Because all these components of the cell are in essence, they're machines, and they're working and they're putting parts together and taking parts apart and absorbing some molecules and transforming them into other molecules. It's just, it's really, really so incredibly complex. Yeah, I mean, I have just a list here of a bunch of things that go on in there, and it's beyond my brain. So this is the cell. It's not coming through very clear. That's the cell membrane. So, you know, we're talking about cells that at one point they thought were just a blob of goop. And now we can understand so clearly that this is the structure. Like, look at that. It's incredible structure. And that's just the bag that holds the cell inside it. This is the composition of the cell membrane. So it's like in two layers. It's like an outer face and an inner face that join together. And then there's other proteins and so on, which create pathways in and out and through between this membrane. It's just, it's so good. There's numbers here of how big it is. It's like between 4 and 10 nanometers in thickness. This is this structure. It's just, it's so miraculous. And then this cell, or this slide, is the flagellum that we talked about. So this would be the cell membrane here with its two layers, and then this would be a motor just built. And this is the thing, it's built into the structure of the membrane of the cell with all these components that all need to be there. They all need to be the perfect right shape in the perfect orientation together, and then they can work, and then they can do whatever they do. And I mentioned earlier about the RPMs that these things spin at, like 100,000 RPMs. It's remarkable. And they're built, they're all constructed. And these things are found in just the simplest, basic, the simplest organisms that we have on the planet. Perfect. All right. So much of this, as I say, from my brain, not being a scientist by any way, is it's incredibly complex. It's incredibly complicated. And for all of this to be in just the simplest single cell, it speaks nothing of the incredible variety of cells, the mind-blowing diversity of all their tasks. We think of our bodies and all the different functions that need to be happening, like, all the time simultaneously with one another. And it's behind the scenes. We don't even think about it. We don't even know that it's happening. They allow us to walk. We can drive here. We can see. We can come in. We can sit down. We can listen. We have the amazing functions of all the components of our bodies. They allow us to eat and to digest and to breathe, and they pump our blood through our bodies. And maybe even more remarkable than this, if it's possible, is that we are conscious. We're able to understand about this. We're able to do the research. We're able to look into these things and discover them. We have the capacity to actually learn and to understand. We're curious as a species. And I think that's absolutely incredible. And I think that's why, in my opinion, that's why God has built these things the way that he has. And so we look into it and we just become more and more and more amazed the deeper we go. And so perhaps we come full circle now to the scriptures we considered at the beginning. As Job said, the beasts, the birds, the earth, and the fishes all teach us of that. And perhaps we've got a taste of that this evening.